Chapter 3. The Wings to Enlightenment. Those principles I have taught you, having directly known them, that is, the four establishings of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four bases of psychic power, the five spiritual faculties, the five spiritual powers, the seven enlightenment factors, the noble eightfold path, you should all train in these principles in concord, with mutual admiration, without disputing. The Buddha, Majjhima Nikaya 103.3. These seven groups, totaling 37 wings to enlightenment, occur frequently in the suttas, were given unique importance by the Buddha, and became a standard doctrinal framework for all schools of Buddhism. As the most important and comprehensive of these groups, we will discuss the Noble Eightfold Path first. The Noble Eightfold Path. In the Buddha's first sermon, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, he warned against pursuing two extremes, devotion to sensuality and devotion to self-torment. He then defined the famous middle way of Buddhism, which does not go anywhere near the two extremes, but leads to peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, nibbana. This is precisely the Noble Eightfold Path, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. The middleness of the middle way has nothing to do with compromise. It is not the mediocre way. It is rather the way that avoids seeking for a solution to life's problems in externals, in the pleasures and pains of the body, but instead turns inwards to the peace of the mind. For this reason, the Buddha would sometimes rephrase his basic teachings on the Eightfold Path with the four jhanas in place of the Eightfold Path as a whole. Bhante, the Blessed One is not devoted to the pursuit of pleasure and sensuality, which is low, vulgar, common, ignoble, and pointless. Nor is he devoted to self-torment, which is painful, ignoble, and pointless. The Blessed One, who gains the four jhanas which constitute the higher mind, and are a blissful abiding here and now at will, without trouble or difficulty. Digha Nikaya 28.19. Note, this paragraph is mistakenly numbered as 20 in the PTS Pali. Not only here do the suttas, emphasizing that samadhi is the path, Anguttara Nikaya 6.64, stand jhanas in the place of the path as a whole. Even the redactors of the canon gave up trying to enumerate all of the ways jhana was praised by the Buddha, merely commenting, "The collection of connected discourses on jhana should be elaborated just as the collection of connected discourses on the path." Samyutta Nikaya 53. Jhana is not merely an adornment or embellishment of the holy vehicle, the Noble Eightfold Path. When the Buddha illustrated the path with the simile of a chariot, he said jhana is the axle, the stable pivot around which the wheel revolves. See Samyutta Nikaya 45. The detailed exposition of the path is as follows. And what, monks, is right view? Knowledge of suffering, of the origin of suffering, of the cessation of suffering, and of the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. This is right view. And what, monks, is right intention? The intention of renunciation, of non-ill will, and of non-cruelty. This is right intention. And what, monks, is right speech? Refraining from lying, slander, harsh speech, and frivolous gossip. This is right speech. And what, monks, is right action? Refraining from killing living beings, from stealing, and from sexual misconduct. This is right action. And what, monks, is right livelihood? Here, monks, a noble disciple having abandoned wrong livelihood, makes his living by right livelihood. This is right livelihood. And what, monks, is right effort? Here, monks, a monk generates enthusiasm, tries, stirs up energy, takes hold of the mind, and strives for the non-arising of unarisen evil, unbeneficial qualities, for the abandoning of arisen evil, unbeneficial qualities, for the arousing of unarisen beneficial qualities, for the stability, non-decline, increase, maturity, and fulfillment of arisen beneficial qualities. This, monks, is right effort. And what, monks, is right mindfulness? Here, monks, a monk abides contemplating a body in the body, feelings in the feelings, a mind in the mind, a Dhamma in the Dhammas, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having removed desire and aversion for the world. And what, monks, is right samadhi? Here, monks, a monk quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unbeneficial qualities, enters and abides in the first jhana, which has initial and sustained application of mind, and rapture and bliss born of seclusion. With the stilling of initial and sustained application of mind, he enters and abides in the second jhana, where there is inner clarity and unification, without initial and sustained application, but with rapture and bliss born of samadhi. With the fading away of rapture, he abides in equanimity, mindful and clearly comprehending, personally experiencing the bliss of which the noble ones say, equanimous and mindful, one abides in bliss. He enters and abides in the third jhana. With the abandoning of bodily pleasure and pain and the previous ending of mental bliss and suffering, he enters and abides in the fourth jhana, which is without pleasure and pain, but has mindfulness fully purified by equanimity. This, monks, is right samadhi. Digha Nikaya 22-21, Majjhima Nikaya 141-23-31, and Samyutta Nikaya 45-8. The first factor, right view, includes the knowledge of the path itself. This, to start with, is wisdom in its preliminary role of providing a theoretical understanding of the path as a necessary prerequisite for setting out on the journey. A distorted understanding of the path will surely act as an effective block to successfully arriving at the destination. Indeed, there are many meditators who, starting practice with wrong views, interpret their meditation experiences so as to confirm and reinforce their misconceptions. Digha Nikaya 1.1.31. But this intellectual understanding is not enough. It must be accompanied by some feeling for the meaning of suffering, an emotional response to the dilemma of existence if it is to provide an effective motivation for action. Hence, the second path factor is right intention, the emotional counterpart of right view, which enables understanding to mature into wisdom rather than lapse into cunning. Endowed with these two, one can rightly undertake the virtues. Right practice of virtue also requires two complementary qualities. Firstly, an understanding of what is right and wrong, together with skill in acting appropriately. Secondly, a feeling of compassion and fear of wrongdoing as motivation. These two qualities will work together in meditation as samatha and vipassana until they culminate in the universal compassion and transcendental wisdom of the arahant. A key benefit of ethical conduct is that it leads to samadhi. Anguttara Nikaya 4.52. Of the basic moral precepts, those against killing and harsh speech counter the hindrance of ill will, those against stealing and adultery counter sensual desire, and those against lying and intoxicants counter delusion. Diligence in executing one's duties and responsibilities, an important aspect of virtue, combats sloth and torpor, while sense restraint and contentment further reduce sensual desire. Each facet of virtue eliminates stress, conflict, and suffering, giving rise to a quiet ease and confidence of heart. This curbing of gross defilements lays the groundwork for the more subtle task of samadhi. So it is that the Buddha declared that purity of virtue and correct view are the starting point of beneficial qualities to be established before undertaking meditation. Samyutta Nikaya 47.3. The last three factors of the path make up the aggregate of samadhi. Right effort, the prerequisite of samadhi, eradicates the hindrance of sloth and torpor. The most interesting of the four right efforts is the last. It points to the importance of not being complacent with whatever good has been achieved. The first task of the meditator who has reached a certain degree of calm is not to rush ahead to insight, but to consolidate samadhi. And remember, effort doesn't mean self-torture. A lazy person abides in suffering, overwhelmed by evil, unbeneficial qualities, and destroys a great deal of their own good. One with roused-up energy abides in bliss, secluded from evil, unbeneficial qualities, and fulfills a great deal for their own good. It is not by the inferior that the topmost is attained. It is by the topmost that the topmost is attained. This holy life, monks, is the cream, and the teacher is right in front of you.
Therefore, you should rouse up energy for the attaining of the unattained, for the achieving of the unachieved, for the witnessing of the unwitnessed. Samyutta Nikaya 12:22. Right mindfulness is defined as the four satipatthanas. Due to the complexity of the topic, we will treat them under their own section as one of the groups of the wings to awakening, rather than under the Eightfold Path. This is not to hide the crucial fact that satipatthana derives its true significance from the fact that they are one of the factors of the path. Since they are included in the section on samadhi rather than the section on wisdom, their primary purpose is to lead to the attainment of jhana as the final factor of the path, right samadhi. Right samadhi. On the occasion when a noble disciple intends to go forth from the home life into homelessness, he is like the celestial coral tree of the Tavatimsa deities when the leaves turn brown. On the occasion when the noble disciple shaves off their hair and beard, puts on the dyed robe, and goes forth from the home life into homelessness, he is like the celestial coral tree when the leaves fall. On the occasion when the noble disciple enters and abides in the first jhana, he is like the celestial coral tree when it is budding. On the occasion when the noble disciple enters and abides in the second jhana, he is like the celestial coral tree when the shoots appear. On the occasion when the noble disciple enters and abides in the third jhana, he is like the celestial coral tree when the blossoms form. On the occasion when the noble disciple enters and abides in the fourth jhana, he is like the celestial coral tree when the flowers are like the red lotus. On the occasion when the noble disciple, due to the evaporation of the poisons, enters and abides in the poison-free release of heart, released by wisdom, having witnessed it with his own direct knowledge, he is like the celestial coral tree of the Tavatimsa deities when it is in full bloom. On that occasion, the earth deities proclaim the news, the venerable one of such and such a name, the student of such and such a venerable one, who went forth from such and such a village or town, has witnessed the evaporation of the poisons. And right at that moment, that instant, the news soars up through the various orders of deities as far as the Brahma realm. Such is the majesty of one who has evaporated the poisons. Anguttara Nikaya 7:65. Right samadhi brings together the other path factors, issuing in right knowledge and release. How well described by the Blessed One who knows and sees the Arahant, the fully enlightened Buddha, are the seven prerequisites of samadhi for the development and fulfillment of right samadhi. What seven? Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, and right mindfulness. One-pointedness of mind with these seven factors as prerequisites is called noble right samadhi with its vital conditions and its prerequisites. Digha Nikaya 18:27 and others. I take one-pointedness of mind in the context of jhana to imply singleness both of consciousness and of object. That is, jhana occurs based on mind consciousness only, without the diversity of sense consciousness. And this mind consciousness knows just one thing. The word point is a translation of the Pali agga, which has superlative connotations difficult to capture in translation. It should not be taken to imply that jhanas are a cramped, narrow state of mind. Rather, they are regularly described as vast, exalted, measureless. It is often asked whether all activity of the five external senses must cease in jhana. From the evidence of the suttas, this certainly seems to be the case. The jhana formula begins with, quite secluded from sensual pleasures. Kama can, in a typical Pali idiom, refer to either the inner attraction to the senses or to the sense objects themselves. Here, the following phrase, secluded from unbeneficial qualities, obviously includes sensual desire, so secluded from sensual pleasures should refer to, or at least include, the sense objects. In fact, when used in plural form, as here, the term kama normally means the objects of the sense. When speaking of desire for the objects, the singular is used. The suttas regularly contrast the plurality of sense experience with the unity of jhana, and so the Buddha said that Noise is a thorn to the first jhana, Anguttara Nikaya 10.72. This might be understood as saying that when sound arises inside the first jhana, it's an obstruction. However, this is not how it should be read, as is made clear by comparing with the statements which follow. Initial and sustained application of mind are a thorn to the second jhana. Rapture is a thorn to the third jhana, and so on. Initial and sustained application of mind are incompatible with the second jhana, cannot exist in it, and if they arise, they signify that one has fallen away from second jhana. So too sound, and by extension the other sense objects, are incompatible with the first jhana, cannot exist in it, and if they arise, they signify that one has fallen away from the first jhana. The following passage bears on this question. And then Venerable Mahamoggallana addressed the monks. Here, friends, when I had attained imperturbable samadhi on the bank of the Sapanika River, I heard the sound of elephants plunging in, crossing over, and trumpeting. On which the Buddha commented, "The meaning is that that samadhi was not fully purified." Moggallana spoke truthfully. Vinaya Parajika 4. This episode presumably refers to Venerable Mahamoggallana's brief but troubled period of striving for enlightenment. Imperturbable usually means at least fourth jhana, or, as we have seen earlier, occasionally the formless attainments. Note, the term imperturbable renders the Pali anenja, which appears as part of the stock phrase describing the mind that has developed the fourth jhana as a basis for higher knowledges. Mahamoggallana is describing an unusual situation, one striking enough to deserve a special mention. If hearing sounds in samadhi were normal, no explanation would be required. Clearly, the monks doubted Mahamoggallana's meaning, and so the Buddha responded by confirming that the samadhi was not perfected, which is why he could still hear sounds. The four jhanas are the ultimate manifestation of the psychology of bliss. The first jhana occurs with the ending of the five external senses and the five hindrances. Relieved of these burdens, the mind is buoyant and at ease, solely preoccupied with one object, the subtle reflection of the mind derived from the basic meditation subject. Because of the nearness of sense activity and defilement, however, the mind must still actively apply itself to that object, first placing, then pressing. This pressing causes the object to recede slightly, so the mind must be replaced, and so on, in an automatic process, which causes a slight ripple or wavering in awareness. As the mind gains more inner confidence, it no longer needs to apply itself, but can simply be at one with the object. The pulsing effect fades away, leaving the clear stillness characteristic of the second jhana. The third jhana is marked by a maturing of the emotional response to blissful feeling. The refined thrill of rapture deepens into the impartial watchfulness of equanimity. Mindfulness and clear comprehension, though like equanimity present from the first jhana, come to the fore as one is fully immersed in bliss without being elated by it. But even that purified bliss exerts the softest of pulls and must be let go as the mind settles down into the fourth jhana, pure, bright watchfulness. Equanimity is now present as both affective tone and emotional attitude, allowing mindfulness to reach its maximum clarity and power. The relative stability of the four jhanas can be gauged from the length of the rebirth they generate. From practicing the first jhana, you get reborn in the Brahma realm for one aeon. For second jhana, two aeons. Third jhana, four aeons, and fourth jhana ensures a rebirth of a full 500 aeons. Anguttara Nikaya 4.123. An aeon in Buddhist, or more broadly Indian cosmology, is comparable to the period from one Big Bang to the next. It is the stability of the neutral feeling in fourth jhana that gives it such potency. It should go without saying that the role of jhana in Buddhist practice is not to attain such states, but this scale helps reflect on the scale of the jhanas. It would seem that the same power that gives rise to such a long rebirth, for those seeking such a thing, will also be the power that leads to the deepest insights, and the fourth jhana in particular is normally used as the basis for realization. Right samadhi is further described as having five factors: suffusion with rapture, suffusion with bliss, suffusion with heart, suffusion with light. It is the basis of reviewing. Dīgha Nikāya 34.1.6 and others. Notice the embodied, immanent language that the Buddha used so typically in describing samadhi. The final of these factors, basis of reviewing, is samadhi as a basis for the investigative reviewing knowledge developed upon emerging from jhana, as described in the following passage. Just as if, monks, one should review another, or one standing should review one sitting, or one sitting should review one lying down. In the same way, a monk has the basis of reviewing well apprehended, well attended, well borne in mind, well penetrated with understanding. Anguttara Nikaya 5.28. The modern Vipassana schools like to say that jhana is a pre-Buddhist practice and hence suspect, not really Buddhist like Vipassana. However, while there was no doubt some practice of samadhi among pre-Buddhist ascetics, this was not the same as Buddhist samadhi. The Brahmin student Subha said that, "I do not see such a fulfilled noble aggregate of samadhi outside of Buddhism, amongst other contemplatives and Brahmins." Dīgha Nikāya 10.2 and Samyutta Nikāya 45.14. How is Buddhist samadhi different? I think it's because it is noble right samadhi with its prerequisites, namely the previous seven factors of the path, starting with right view. The actual state of concentration may be similar, but it plays a different role in the spiritual path. It is associated with five knowledges. Monks, develop samadhi that is measureless, masterly, and mindful. When samadhi is developed that is measureless, masterly, and mindful, five personal knowledges arise. What five? The personal knowledge arises. This samadhi is blissful now and results in bliss in the future. This samadhi is noble and spiritual. This samadhi is not cultivated by bad men. This samadhi is peaceful and refined, tranquil, unified, not actively controlled or constrained. I enter and emerge mindfully from this samadhi. Dīgha Nikāya 34.1.6 and Anguttara Nikāya 5.27. The modern Vipassana schools like to say that jhana is a pre-Buddhist practice and hence is suspect, not really Buddhist like Vipassana. However, while there was no doubt some practice of samadhi among pre-Buddhist ascetics, this was not the same as Buddhist samadhi. The Brahmin student Subha said that, "I do not see such a fulfilled noble aggregate of samadhi outside of Buddhism amongst other contemplatives and Brahmins." Dīgha Nikāya 10.2, Samyutta Nikāya 45.14. How is Buddhist samadhi different? I think it's because it is noble right samadhi with its prerequisites, namely the previous seven factors of the path starting with right view. The actual state of concentration may be similar, but it plays a different role in the spiritual path. It is associated with five knowledges. Monks, develop samadhi that is measureless, masterly, and mindful. When samadhi is developed that is measureless, masterly, and mindful, five personal knowledges arrive. What five? The personal knowledge arises. This samadhi is blissful now and in bliss in the future. This samadhi is noble and spiritual. This samadhi is not cultivated by bad men. This samadhi is peaceful and refined, tranquil, unified, not actively controlled or constrained. I enter and emerge mindfully from this samadhi. Dīgha Nikāya 34.1.6 and Anguttara Nikāya 5.27. These descriptions have nothing to do with the concepts of momentary samadhi or transcendental path moment samadhi. They simply refer to the practice of jhana by one developing the noble path. The conception of the path as support for noble right samadhi might be described in this way. The course of meditation for one on the noble path has been smoothed by the right view that has eliminated or lessened certain defilements, such as doubt or sensual desire, according to the stage of progress. Furthermore, at the actual time of developing samadhi, the previously developed right view manifests as a clear awareness of what is beneficial and what is unbeneficial, as well as an understanding of the causal relationships between mental factors leading to peace of mind. The path factor of right intention manifests as undistracted application to the meditation object, while the previously purified virtue gives rise to the gladness of non-remorse. Together with energy and mindfulness, these factors lead to jhana. These jhanas, as noble right samadhi itself, are similar in their basic function and natures to jhana practiced outside the Eightfold Path. However, due to the exceptional purity of the factors instrumental in their attaining, they are singularly pellucid and tranquil, yielding an intuitive flowering of wisdom. Upon emerging mindfully, the noble one will review the jhana with wisdom. They will see that the bliss in that jhana arose from letting go, and that continuing that process of letting go will culminate in the ultimate bliss of nibbana. Noble right samadhi closes the circle. Although the last factor of the path, its fruit is the perfection of the first factor, the right view normally associated with the stream enterer. The path includes the truths. The truths include the path. The Dhamma is like a hologram image. When it is broken, each fragment contains not a part, but the whole of the original image. Monks develop samadhi. A monk who has samadhi understands in accordance with reality. What does he understand in accordance with reality? He understands this is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. Samyutta Nikaya 56.1. The Four Satipatthanas. Right mindfulness, the basis of samadhi, Samyutta Nikaya 56.1, is the gatekeeper who lets both samatha and vipassana enter with their message in accordance with reality. Here, nimitta, rendered as basis, may also mean sign, since samadhi is certainly characterized by unobstructed mindfulness. But the intended contextual meaning seems to be that satipatthana is a crucial support for samadhi. In keeping with the theme of this essay, of the mutual harmony between all aspects of the path, let us look more closely at the relationship of mindfulness with samadhi and vipassana. In the analysis that follows, I will not be extensively quoting from the Satipatthana Sutta as such. This is already widely known and widely available, and if you have not yet read it, you should. My aim is not to explain the Satipatthana Sutta, but to show its deep and rich integration with the very many other teachings on practice found in the texts. Mindfulness may be characterized as the quality of mind that recollects and focuses awareness within an appropriate frame of reference, bearing in mind the what, why, and how of the task at hand. Mindfulness as a mental quality plays a crucial role in collecting the teachings and applying them to the present moment, thus supporting right view. By reminding one of what is right and wrong, it supports the sense of conscience, which is vital for virtue. Satipatthana, the establishings of mindfulness, refers to a specific and detailed set of contemplative exercises in which mindfulness plays a prominent role. The development of satipatthana refers to the advanced employment of the basic exercises for the contemplation of impermanence. The way of practice leading to the development of satipatthana is the Noble Eightfold Path. Samyutta Nikaya 47.40. In this analysis, satipatthana seems to have the function of supporting samadhi, the development of satipatthana, that of supporting insight, while both of these in the overall context of the path lead to liberation. The classic formula uses a reflexive idiom, saying one contemplates a body in the body. This is explained in the suttas as, the in and out breaths are a certain body among the bodies. Majjhima Nikaya 118. This implies focusing on a specific aspect of the overall framework. The explanation that the phrase means contemplating the body as a body and not as a self or soul does not ring true, since the phrase pertains as much to samadhi as to insight. Satipatthana and the hindrances. Each of the contemplations in satipatthana is qualified by a set of four terms. The first term, ardent, refers to energy. The second, clearly comprehending, to understanding. The third is mindfulness itself. The fourth term indicates the abandoning of desire and aversion, which are the chief of the five hindrances. The phrase is not further defined here, but the following verses may be relevant. Bearing in mind that sequence in such verses is often quite loose, we may note that these verses follow teachings chiefly on virtue, including sense restraint, but jhana and samadhi have also been mentioned. And then there are these five stains in the world, for the removal of which the mindful one should train. One should overcome lust for visible forms, sounds, tastes, smells, and touches. Having removed desire for these phenomena, a monk, mindful, with mind well released, rightly examining Dhamma at the right time, unified, he shatters the darkness. A series of four steps of the Dhamma lists freedom from desire, freedom from ill will, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. It seems that the preliminary subduing of these hindrances through sense restraint, etc., prepares the mind for mindfulness practice, which is the foundation for the complete eradication of hindrances by right samadhi. One should abide without desire, with heart free from ill will, mindful. One should be of one pointed mind, well concentrated in samadhi within. Anguttara Nikaya 4:29 and 30. Contemplation of the hindrances present in the mind is part of the preliminary development of satipatthana. But during the course of practice, they must be fully abandoned if one is to realize any truly noble distinctions of knowledge and vision beyond human principles, which include jhana, psychic powers, the stages of enlightenment, and satipatthana itself as a factor of the noble path. Vinaya Parajika 4:4. Monks, these five hindrances choke the mind, robbing understanding of its strength. What five? Sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt are obstructions and hindrances. Certainly, monks, that any monk with understanding thus feeble and robbed of strength, not having abandoned these five hindrances which choke the mind, robbing understanding of its strength, would know his own welfare, another's welfare, or the welfare of both, or witness any truly noble distinction of knowledge and vision beyond human principles. That is possible. Anguttara Nikaya 5:51. It is a common idiom in Pali that the same thing can be spoken of in positive or negative terms as an attainment or an abandoning. For example, the process of enlightenment can be described either as the successive abandoning of the defilements of self-view, doubt, etc., or as the attaining of the stages of stream entry, once return, non-return, and arahant. What, then, is the positive counterpart of the abandoning of the hindrances? The first jhana, friend, abandons five factors and possesses five factors. Here, friend, when a monk has entered upon the first jhana, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt are abandoned. Initial and sustained application of mind, rapture, bliss, and one-pointedness of mind are occurring. Majjhima Nikaya 43:20. The opposition between jhana and the five hindrances is not a one-off or occasional teaching, but is a central doctrine frequently reiterated. It is even enshrined in the basic cosmology of Buddhism, which sees the worlds of rebirth as corresponding to the level of development of mind. One still bound by sensual desire will be reborn in the sensual realm, Kamaloka, while one who attains jhana will be reborn in the Brahma realm. There is no access realm. What should be done, Anuruddha, by a clansman who has gone forth thus? While he still does not achieve the rapture and bliss that are secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unbeneficial qualities, or to something more peaceful than that, desire invades his mind and remains, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, doubt, cynicism, listlessness invades his mind and remains. When he achieves that rapture and bliss, or something more peaceful than that, desire does not invade his mind and remain. Ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, doubt, cynicism, listlessness does not invade his mind and remain. Majjhima Nikaya 68.6. The following statement by Venerable Ananda clarifies the standard the Buddha took for what he considered praiseworthy meditation, able to go beyond the hindrances. What kind of jhana did the Blessed One not praise? Here, someone abides with a heart dominated by and prey to lust for sensual pleasures, ill will, sloth and torpor, restless and remorse, doubt. Harboring these qualities within and not understanding the escape from these qualities in accordance with reality, they do jhana, redo jhana, outdo jhana, and misdo jhana. The Blessed One did not praise this kind of jhana. But what kind of jhana did the Blessed One praise? Here a monk enters and abides in the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. The Blessed One praised this kind of jhana. Majjhima Nikaya 108.26-27. Even the transcendental wisdom of the noble ones is unable to suppress the hindrances without the support of jhana. Even though a noble disciple has seen clearly, with right understanding in accordance with reality, how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering, much despair, with great danger, as long as he does not attain the rapture and bliss that are apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unbeneficial qualities, he is not involved in sensual pleasures. But when he does attain that rapture and bliss, he is uninvolved in sensual pleasures. Majjhima Nikaya 14.4 and 68.6. This passage is one of those that has been used regularly to suggest that jhanas are not really necessary. Using the kind of logic that seems so persuasive to the Vipassana schools, a passage that is taught in order to quite explicitly praise jhana and emphasize its necessity is pressed into service to argue that a noble disciple need not have jhana. But the context in no way supports this. The sutta was taught by the Buddha to Mahanama, a Sakyan layman. His problem is not, what is the way of practice to become a stream enterer, but, now that I am a stream enterer, how do I deal with sensual desires that arise from time to time? The Buddha reminds him that, since our pleasure-seeking tendencies are so strong, only through the bliss of jhana are we able to truly let go of the pleasures of the sense. It is Mahanama's practice now that is the issue, not the practice that brought him to stream entry in the first place. No doubt he could have attained a peaceful and profound meditation state that led to his insight, but, like most of us, found it difficult to maintain this in everyday life. His state of realization, of course, would not decay, but as long as he is not fully enlightened, defilements can arise from time to time that would obstruct his further progress. The Buddha compared jhana to gold. As long as the impurities have not been completely removed, gold is not soft, workable, or radiant. So too there are these five taints of the mind, tainted by which the mind is not soft, not workable, nor radiant, but is brittle, and does not have right samadhi for the evaporation of the poisons. What five? Sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. But when the mind is released from these five taints, that mind is soft, workable, radiant, not brittle, and it has right samadhi for the evaporation of the poisons. Anguttara Nikaya 5.13. The phrase, having removed desire and aversion for the world, found so commonly in the Satipatthana formula, may be replaced by samadhi. Monks, those monks who are new, not long gone forth, recently come to this Dhamma and Vinaya, should be spurred on, encouraged, and established by you in the development of the four establishings of mindfulness. What for? Come, friends, abide contemplating a body in the body, a feeling in the feelings, a mind in the mind, a Dhamma in the Dhammas, ardent, clearly comprehending, unified, with clarity of mind, concentrated in samadhi, with mind one-pointed for the knowledge of the body, feelings, mind, and dhammas in accordance with reality. Those monks who are trainees, not yet attained to their heart's goal, who abide longing for the unexcelled security from bondage, they too abide contemplating a body in the body, a feeling in the feelings, a mind in the mind, and a dhamma in the dhammas, in the same way, for the full knowledge of these things. Those monks who are arahants, they too abide contemplating a body in the body, feeling in the feelings, a mind in the mind, a dhamma in the dhammas in that same way, but detached from these things.
Samyutta Nikaya 47.4.
Such passages show that Satipatthana, far from being separate from or opposed to jhana, is in fact indistinguishable from it. Note that the above passage, as is typical, distinguishes between individuals at various stages of development in terms of the goal, not the mode of practice. There is no suggestion that one in a preliminary state of development need not develop jhana, and that this is only necessary for higher attainments. On the contrary, the investigative aspect of Satipatthana must be balanced with the emotional qualities of joy and serenity if obstacles are to be overcome and insight is to be deepened. This process can proceed in various modes. Therefore, monks, you should train yourself thus. My mind will be still and steady within myself, and arisen evil, unbeneficial qualities will not invade my mind and remain. When this is accomplished, you should train yourself thus. I will develop the heart's release through loving kindness, compassion, admiration, and equanimity. When this samadhi is thus developed and made much of, then you should develop this samadhi with initial and sustained application of mind, without initial but with sustained application of mind, with neither initial nor sustained application of mind, with rapture, without rapture, with enjoyment, with equanimity. When this samadhi is thus developed, well developed, then you should train yourself thus. I will abide contemplating a body in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having removed desire and aversion for the world. When this samadhi is thus developed and made much of, then you should develop this samatha with initial and sustained application of mind, without initial but with sustained application of mind, with neither initial nor sustained application of mind, with rapture, without rapture, with enjoyment, with equanimity, and so on for feelings, mind, and dhammas.
Anguttara Nikaya 8.63.
Here, Satipatthana is treated simply as jhana. This probably refers to jhana developed using one of the exercises included in the four Satipatthanas. If one's original mode of Satipatthana fails to lead to samadhi, the meditator should find some way to uplift the mind. Thus dwelling, contemplating a body in the body, feelings, mind, dhammas, bodily disturbance arises based on the body, feelings, mind, dhammas. Or the heart is lazy, or the mind is distracted externally. That monk should direct his mind to some inspiring basis. Doing so, gladness is born in him. In one who is glad, rapture is born. In one with rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One with tranquil body feels bliss. In one who is blissful, the mind enters samadhi. He considers thus, I have accomplished that purpose for which I directed my mind. Let me now withdraw. He withdraws and neither initiates nor sustained application of mind. He understands, I am without initial and sustained application of mind. I am mindful and blissful within myself.
Samyutta Nikaya 47.10.
There's another passage where, instead of the phrase, having removed desire and aversion for the world, the sutta simply states, I am blissful. He understands, as I abide contemplating a body in the body, a feeling in the feelings, a mind in the mind, a dhamma in the dhammas, ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful, I am blissful. Samyutta Nikaya 47.10.
The four focuses. Number one, body. The contemplation of the body begins with mindfulness of breathing. This is therefore the most fundamental Satipatthana practice. If this is borne in mind, the intimacy between Satipatthana and Samadhi, as evidenced in the above passages, becomes easily understood. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four establishings of mindfulness. When the four establishings of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven factors of enlightenment. When the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they fulfill realization and release. Majjhima Nikaya 118.15. Body contemplation then continues with development of awareness of the body postures, parts of the body, elements, and corpses. The contemplation on parts of the body and corpses is primarily a samatha practice designed to remove lust, and so such a meditator is said to not neglect jhana. Anguttara Nikaya 1.20. Although I refer to this chapter a few times, it is a highly schematic passage, probably assembled quite late, and in part incongruous. For example, one who develops right speech is said to not neglect jhana, which does not make much sense, even if we interpret jhana here as broadly meditation. Contemplation of body postures throughout daily activities is a bit of an odd one out here. Such a practice seems insufficient to induce jhana, and so the appearance of the practice here is a cornerstone of the modern idea that observation of body postures may even replace concentrative meditation. In fact, this practice is one of the preliminaries to developing meditation, rather than as meditative practice itself, as is borne out by the constant appearance in the gradual training before satipatthana. Only in this one isolated instance, repeated in the Kayagata Sati Sutta, is this practice treated as if it were part of meditation itself. Most of the non-Pali versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, in fact, omit this practice or place it prior to breath meditation. Nevertheless, it is undeniably true that continuity of mindfulness throughout the day is crucial to both samatha and vipassana. As the words again and beyond at the start of each section of the Satipatthana Sutta indicate, each exercise contributes a part of the overall meditative development. The Kayagata Sati Sutta repeats each of these contemplations but brings out the samatha side, saying in each case, "As he abides thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, his memories and intentions based on the household life are abandoned. With their abandoning, his mind becomes steadied within himself, settled, unified, and concentrated in samadhi. This is how a monk develops mindfulness of the body." Majjhima Nikaya 119.4. The basic purpose of the contemplations on the body parts, elements, and corpses is to rise above sensuality. If one believes that sensuality is an intrinsic quality of human nature, this objective will seem perverse, an unnatural repression leading inevitably to neurosis. Lust can indeed lead to neurosis if it is unacknowledged and denied. But seeing sensual desire not as a permanent property, but as a conditioned phenomenon, one is free to investigate its effect on the happiness of the mind. Sensual lust is fueled by focusing on the attractiveness of the body. By going against the stream of habit, focusing attention on the unattractive aspects of the body, sensual lust can be seen in sharp relief. This is not repression, quite the opposite. It is broadening our experience to accept unpleasant aspects of our humanity, which we normally prefer to repress. When the flame of desire is deprived of its fuel, it simply goes out, and the mind experiences a coolness and bliss. Then one knows that the real repression, the real perversion, the real neurosis is the addiction to sensual gratification, locked in place by denying the futility of sense pleasures. But these contemplations do not only bestow the emotional maturity, dignity, and independence that come from freedom from addiction. Being based on inquiry into reality, they also serve to deepen wisdom. The most suggestive description of the contemplation of the parts of the body treats this as a stepping stone to understanding the consciousness which does not die with the body. There are, Bhante, these four attainments of vision. Here a certain contemplative or Brahman, by means of ardor, striving, devotion, heedfulness, and right attention, contacts such a form of heart samadhi, that when his mind is in samadhi, he reviews this very body, up from the soles of the feet and down to the tips of the hair, surrounded by skin and full of many kinds of impurities, thus: in this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, large intestines, small intestines, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. This is the first attainment of vision. Again, having done this and gone beyond it, he reviews a person's skin, flesh, bone, and blood. This is the second attainment of vision. Again, having done this and gone beyond it, he understands a person's stream of consciousness, unbroken on both sides, fixated in this world and in the world beyond. This is the third attainment of vision. Again, having done this and gone beyond it, he understands a person's stream of consciousness, unbroken on both sides, fixated neither in this world nor in the world beyond. This is the fourth attainment of vision. Digha Nikaya 28:7. The opening phrase is unusual, but occurs again later in the same sutta and also in the Brahmajala Sutta, Digha Nikaya 1:1:31. In both places, heart samadhi definitely means jhana. The third attainment is the realization of the passing on of consciousness according to dependent origination, which is the realization of the stream enterer. The fourth attainment describes the arahant. Hence, this passage shows that, when used as a basis for samadhi and insight, body contemplation is not merely a way to get beyond desire, but leads to emancipation from suffering. In the following passage, the contemplation of the four elements forms a part of the practice directed towards the imperturbable, which, as we have remarked, normally refers to the fourth jhana. Again, monks, a noble disciple reflects thus. There are sensual pleasures here and now, and sensual pleasures in lives to come. Whatever physical form there is the four great elements and physical form derived from the four great elements. Practicing in this way and frequently abiding thus, his mind becomes clear about this base. When there is full clarity, he attains to the imperturbable now, or he decides upon understanding. With the breaking up of the body after death, it is possible that his onflowing consciousness will pass on to the imperturbable. Majjhima Nikaya 106:4. Notice the order of the teaching: sensuality, body contemplation, jhana, understanding, rebirth. It would seem that it is no coincidence that descriptions of near-death experiences so uncannily resemble the experience of jhana. We will return again to the intimate connection between the mind in jhana, set free from the body, and the understanding of the process of rebirth. The four focuses. Number two, feelings. Normally in Buddhism, feeling, vedana, simply refers to the hedonic or affective tone of experience. The Satipatthana Sutta describes the contemplation of feelings as the understanding of pleasant, painful, and neutral feelings, both carnal and spiritual. However, the equivalent section of the Anapanasati Sutta brings in rapture, the emotional response to pleasant feeling, and mental activities, citta sankhara, which are defined as the context of mindfulness of breathing as feeling and perception. Majjhima Nikaya 44:14. This seems to broaden the scope of feelings here as far as emotions, moods. The important thing, however, is that when these feelings are explicitly analyzed in the suttas, they are identified with the feelings experienced in jhana. What, monks, is carnal rapture? Rapture which arises dependent on the five chords of sensual pleasure. What is spiritual rapture? Here a monk enters and abides in the first jhana, second jhana. What is even more spiritual rapture? Rapture which arises when a monk whose poisons are evaporated reviews his mind released from lust, anger, and delusion. Samyutta Nikaya 36:31. Taragata 85. Pleasant and neutral feelings are described in similar terms, except pleasant and spiritual feelings apply to the first three jhanas, while neutral spiritual feelings only exist in the fourth jhana. This analysis of feelings is specific to the Satipatthana Sutta, and the suttas do not offer any alternate explanation. Occasionally, it is true, spiritual rapture is used prior to jhana, but this is not part of the full set of contemplations as found in the Satipatthana Sutta. Moreover, in such contexts, it appears as one of the conditions leading to full samadhi, not a replacement for it. For example, Samyutta Nikaya 46:3, as quoted below. Reading straightforwardly from the suttas, contemplation of feelings in Satipatthana requires the experience of jhana.
The last of these contemplations is the Arahant's reviewing knowledge. This is specifically distinguished from the feelings in jhana, and hence one cannot argue that this can replace jhana. Note, these even more spiritual feelings seem to be similar to the feelings based on renunciation mentioned elsewhere, which, however, since they follow on seeing with right understanding and in accordance with reality, seem broader, pertaining to stream entry and beyond. See Majjhima Nikaya 137, 11, or 15. The Four Focuses. Number 3. Mind. Mind, citta, in Pali as in English, can convey a wide variety of connotations. Here, as will be clarified below, it means specifically cognition, that is, the faculty of awareness itself, as distinct from associated factors such as feeling, emotion, thought, volition, etc. This inner sense of knowing receives the information conveyed through the senses, supplemented and processed by these associated factors. As the lord of the city seated at the crossroads, it is the core of experience. But like any ruler, it can maintain its position only with the help of its auxiliaries. The quality of the information received is the critical determinant of the quality of awareness. Also, like any ruler, it often seems that the auxiliaries impede rather than facilitate the flow of information. The more we try to see the boss, the more we are sidetracked with some underling. The preliminary stages of this section involve contemplating the mind as colored by the presence or absence of greed, anger, and delusion. These accompanying factors are crude and domineering, and the contemplation necessarily coarse and incomplete. In the later stages, the mind is contemplated in its pure form as exalted, unexcelled, concentrated, released, all terms for jhana. Just as the contemplation of feelings culminates in the supreme equanimity of the fourth jhana, here too the term unexcelled implies the unexcelled purity of mindfulness and equanimity of the fourth jhana. Majjhima Nikaya 54, 22-24, and Majjhima Nikaya 53, 20-22. This contemplation of mind, with its implicit distinction between the mind and the defilements which soil it, is reminiscent of the famous and famously misquoted statement about the radiant mind. The words original mind or naturally radiant do not occur here or elsewhere in the suttas. The radiant mind is a term for jhana, Samyutta Nikaya 46.33 and Anguttara Nikaya 5.23. Here, development of the mind seems to be a synonym for noble right samadhi. The significance of the radiant mind is simply this: when the lights are on, a clear-sighted person can see what is there. Monks, this mind is radiant, but tainted by transient taints. An unlearned, ordinary person does not understand this in accordance with reality. That is why I say there is no development of the mind for the unlearned, ordinary person. Monks, this mind is radiant and freed from transient taints. A learned, noble disciple understands this in accordance with reality. That is why I say there is development for the mind of the learned, noble disciple. Anguttara Nikaya 1, 6.1 and 2. The Four Focuses, Number 4, Dhammas. What does Dhammas mean here? Dhammas is used in the Satipatthana Sutta in its catch-all role, including what is experienced, phenomena, how experience operates, principles, and the meaningful description of experience, teachings. In research subsequent to the original publication of this work, I concluded that the specification of contemplation of Dhammas was originally much narrower, comprising just the five hindrances and the seven awakening factors. In A History of Mindfulness, I have argued this point in detail. For the current work, however, I have chosen to proceed based on the Pali texts as they are. Contemplation of Dhammas is often translated as contemplation of mental phenomena or mental objects. The practices detailed in the sutta, however, cover a much broader scope than mental phenomena. The contemplation of mental phenomena not found in the Satipatthana Sutta as such is a minor practice taught only occasionally. the realization of feelings, perceptions, and thoughts as they rise, remain, and end. Digha-Nikaya 33:11, etc. This practice is called a development of samadhi. In teaching sequence, it appears after jhana and before the contemplation of the five aggregates. Its fruit is said to be mindfulness and clear comprehension, but it is not said to lead to awakening as such. This is because mental phenomena are the known, not the knowing. Insight frees only when the radical impermanence of consciousness itself is brought within its fold. The contemplation of Dhammas begins with the contemplation of the five hindrances, present and absent. The diversity of these hindrances demands a diversity of approaches for their elimination. Sensual desire colors the mind like water dyed vivid blue or crimson, making it attractive but opaque. These similes are from Anguttara Nikaya 3:193. The most important countermeasures are sense restraint and the meditation on ugliness. Ill will is a fire which heats the mind until it is boiling, bubbling, and steaming. It is overcome by loving kindness. The Buddha said that by using mindfulness alone, it is not possible to fully overcome ill will. It is always good for the mindful one thrives in bliss. It is better each day for the mindful one, but he is not released from enmity. For one whose mind all day and night finds delight in harmlessness, who has loving kindness for all beings, for him there is enmity with none. Samyutta Nikaya 1:813-814. Sloth and torpor is like a mossy, slimy weed overgrowing the clear waters of the mind. It is overcome by initiative, by putting forth effort, by sustained exertion, by non-complacency. The recommended meditation subject is the perception of light. Restlessness and remorse are like strong winds which lash and stir up the mind into ripples and waves. Restlessness manifests as the inability to stay with one object for a long time. The Buddha was very explicit on how to overcome this. Samatha should be developed to abandon restlessness. Anguttara Nikaya 6:116. Or again, mindfulness of breathing should be developed to abandon scatteredness of heart. Anguttara Nikaya 6:115. Remorse, kukkacha, literally bad doneness, is chiefly worry over breaches of virtue or regret over what was wrongly done or undone in the past. Restlessness runs on to the future. Remorse dredges up the past. Their antidote, keeping the mind content in the here and now, is bliss. The pervasive drenching of the whole field of awareness with serene, sublime, sustained ecstasy. Doubt makes the mind turbid, muddy, and dark. It is overcome by paying attention to the root. Anguttara Nikaya 1:2. The root, or basis of meditation, is just the meditation object itself. Unwavering continuity of application defines the object, dispelling doubt. It is worth noting that mindfulness is nowhere singled out as being in and of itself capable of overcoming any hindrance. Only when working together with the other factors of jhana can this occur. The following passage makes this clear. The meditator abandons the hindrances and does satipatthana, but the subsequent paragraph shows that this satipatthana is in fact the first jhana. To deepen one's satipatthana, one must deepen one's practice of jhana. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, taints of the mind which rob understanding of its strength, he abides contemplating a body in the body, a feeling in the feelings, a mind in the mind, a Dhamma in the Dhammas. Then the Tathagata leads him further on. Come, monk, abide contemplating a body in the body, a feeling in the feelings, a mind in the mind, a Dhamma in the Dhammas, but do not apply the mind to these things. With the stilling of initial and sustained application of mind, he enters and abides in the second jhana. Majjhima Nikaya 125:22-25, condensed. After dealing with the hindrances, the next section in the Pali Satipatthana Sutta deals with the classic Vipassana exercise of observing the rise and fall of the five aggregates. Monks, develop samadhi. A monk with samadhi understands in accordance with reality. What does he understand in accordance with reality? The origin and ending of physical form, feeling, perception, conceptual activities, and consciousness. What is the origin of physical form? For one who relishes, welcomes, and remains attached to physical form, relishing arises. Relishing for physical form is grasping. Due to grasping as condition, there is ongoing existence. Due to existence as condition, there is birth. Due to birth as condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, bodily pain, mental suffering, and despair come to be. Thus, there is the origin of this entire mass of suffering. And so on for the other four aggregates. And what is the ending of physical form? For one who does not relish, welcome, and remain attached to physical form, relishing for physical form ceases. Due to the cessation of relishing, grasping ceases. Due to the cessation of grasping, ongoing existence ceases. Due to the cessation of existence, birth ceases. Due to the cessation of birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, bodily pain, mental suffering, and despair cease. Thus, there is the cessation of this entire mass of suffering. And so on for the other four aggregates. Samyutta Nikaya 22.5. Here, understanding impermanence is not the perception of conditioned phenomena arising and passing instantaneously, but understanding how attachment leads to rebirth in accordance with dependent origination. As always, such profound insights arise due to the clarity of the mind in samadhi. The next closely related practice is the observation of the six internal and external sense bases and the fetters that bind these together. Once again, this practice is explicitly said to be dependent on developing samadhi. Monks develop samadhi. A monk with samadhi understands in accordance with reality. What does he understand in accordance with reality? He understands the eye is impermanent, visible forms are impermanent, eye consciousness is impermanent, eye contact is impermanent, feeling arisen due to eye contact is impermanent, and so on for the ear, etc. Samyutta Nikaya 35.99. The contemplation of Dhammas also includes the contemplation of the seven enlightenment factors: mindfulness, investigation of Dhammas, energy, rapture, tranquility, samadhi, and equanimity, discussed in more detail below, and their fulfillment by development. Here, samadhi is not merely implied as it has been in other sections of the Satipatthana Sutta, but it is mentioned by name. And the Satipatthana meditator is instructed to fulfill this samadhi through development. The final section is the contemplation of the Four Noble Truths. Elsewhere, the Buddha said these are taught for one who feels. It is for one who feels that I declare, this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, this is the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. Anguttara Nikaya 3.61. The point here is that the experience of suffering is fundamental to our spiritual pursuit. Pain is not an incidental to the practice, it underlies it. To understand the Four Noble Truths is not to make oneself experience even more pain, but to understand how to transcend pain through letting go. The bliss of jhana is a crucial teaching, showing us clearly and directly that suffering arises from our attachments. This is why it is regarded as a foretaste of nibbana. The Four Noble Truths are briefly mentioned in the Satipatthana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 10, but are described in detail in the Maha Satipatthana Sutta, Digha Nikaya 22. Actually, Digha Nikaya 22 is nothing more than a late expansion of Majjhima Nikaya 10, with the expanded section on the Four Noble Truths taken from the Saccha Vibhaga Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 141, and inserted by the redactors. It is not an authentic teaching of the Buddha, but nevertheless, it gives an idea of how these things were understood by the Theravadan redactors, perhaps 200 to 300 years after the Buddha. This is discussed in detail in my A History of Mindfulness. The first noble truth is the various kinds of suffering headed by birth, aging, and death. The second is that craving which generates repeated existence, while the third is the ending of that very same craving. The fourth noble truth, the way of practice, is the noble eightfold path as detailed above, including the four jhanas as right samadhi. Thus, once again, the Theravadan scriptures explicitly include jhana as an integral part of satipatthana practice. Insight. Each exercise included in the four establishings of mindfulness concludes with a passage describing various aspects of insight development. This insight refrain is a template for understanding how these practices are meant to be applied in this context. These refrain sections vary considerably between the different versions, and the Pali Sutta is one of the few to so strongly emphasize vipassana here. For example, in the version of this material that is found in the Pali Abhidhamma Vibhaga, there is no mention of a vipassana refrain. It seems that it is the presence of this refrain which constantly reinforces the message of vipassana, which has given rise to the unique modern Theravadan idea that satipatthana is essentially a vipassana practice. It is crucial to realize that this refrain is an unusual feature of one particular text and does not represent the teachings on satipatthana found elsewhere. In over 70 suttas dealing with satipatthana in the Pali canon alone, only two or three others even mention impermanence. Contrast this with the dozens of cases where satipatthana is closely associated with samadhi. The modern doctrine of satipatthana equals vipassana is an artifact of a selective and misrepresentative reading of the texts. Nevertheless, despite our strong reservations about the authenticity of this passage and its overemphasis in modern teachings, we'll still have a look at it and show that while vipassana is being emphasized, especially in the section on rise and fall, this is by no means separate from samatha. Insight number one, internal and external. First, one contemplates within oneself and externally. This phrase is commonly mentioned in the Pali, but is rarely defined explicitly. The following passage is perhaps the only place where we are given a clearer idea of what this contemplation involves in the context of satipatthana. As so often, the suttas themselves say that samadhi and satipatthana are closely linked. Here, good man, a monk abides contemplating a body in the body within himself, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having removed desire and aversion for the world. As he abides thus, he becomes concentrated therein with right samadhi, with right clarity. Rightly concentrated and clear therein, he gives rise to knowledge and visions of the bodies of others externally, and so on for feelings, mind, and dhammas. Digha Nikaya 18:26. This explanation shows that the internal contemplation is the preliminary satipatthana meditation that leads to jhana. This would normally be one of the objects such as the breath. The breath is internal to one's own experience of one's body. Focusing awareness there, the body is restrained from wandering outside and becomes peaceful and still inside, from the subjective perspective of the meditator. Only when this process is complete may the meditator then extend their awareness outside. The phrase knowledge and vision refers to the various psychic powers, such as the divine ear or divine eye, which enable a meditator who has developed the ultra-refined consciousness of jhana to extend their awareness of externals. Since by this stage the mind is very still and the hindrances are completely absent, there is no danger that the meditator will become distracted or lose focus in this external contemplation. Insight number two, impermanence. The second aspect of insight development is the contemplation of the principles of origination and dissolution. Here is a story that exemplifies the sutta's pragmatic approach to impermanence. Long ago, monks, there was a teacher called Araka, a ford crosser, free from lust for sensual pleasures, with many hundreds of disciples. Araka, the teacher, taught Dhamma to his disciples thus: short is the life of humans, limited and trifling, with much suffering, much despair. Wake up by using your mind, do good, live the holy life. There is none born who does not die. Just as drops of dew on the tip of a blade of grass when the sun rises, just as a bubble in the water appears when it rains, just as a line drawn on water with a stick, just as a mountain stream traveling far, fast flowing, sweeping all before it, never pausing for a moment, a second, an instant, but ever going on, rolling on, surging on, just as a man might form a gob of spit on the tip of his tongue and spit it out easily, just like a lump of meat thrown on an iron griddle which has been heated all day, just like a cow being led to the slaughter with each step she is closer to being killed, closer to death. In the same way, the life of humans is like a cow to be slaughtered, limited and trifling, with much suffering, much despair. Wake up by using your mind. Do good. Live the holy life. There is none born who does not die. Now, at that time, monks, the lifespan of humans was 60,000 years, and girls were marriageable at 500 years. Humans had only 6 afflictions: cold, heat, hunger, thirst, excrement, and urine. And even though humans were of such a long life, duration, and little affliction, still Arika the teacher taught Dhamma in this way. But now who lives long lives but 100 years, or a little more. I have done for you what should be done by a teacher seeking the welfare of his disciples out of compassion. Here, monks, are roots of trees. Here are empty huts. Practice jhana, monks. Do not be negligent. Do not regret it later. This is our instruction to you. Anguttara Nikaya 7:70. This is a fable, a legend of long ago, and it is not so important whether it was meant to be taken literally as it is to understand the message. All things that we hold on to in this life will fall away. I mentioned earlier that the suttas rarely discuss impermanence in the context of Satipatthana, except for the Satipatthana Sutta. Luckily, however, in the main case where this does happen, the text gives a clear and explicit explanation. Here is the sutta text. The body originates due to the origination of nutriment. The body ends due to the cessation of nutriment. Feelings originate due to the origination of contact. Feelings end due to the cessation of contact. The mind originates due to the origination of mentality and physical form. The mind ends due to the cessation of mentality and physical form. Dhammas originate due to the origination of attention. Dhammas end due to the cessation of attention. Samyutta Nikaya 47:42. Taken in isolation, this passage probably doesn't make much sense, but each of these terms is well defined elsewhere in the suttas.
Insight 2.1. Impermanence of the body. The origin of the body is said to be nutriment, ahara, which here means simply material food. On a basic level, this simply means that food is what sustains the body, with all that implies. We are dependent on the means of producing food, so ensuring that there is bread on the table has been one of humanity's most pressing needs, right down to the present day. As long as we are still in this realm, in this body built up of rice and bread, then the search for and reliance on food will never end. So much of our mental energy revolves around food, the getting, preparing, and eating of it. Small wonder that the Buddha pointed out that attachment to food is one of the forces driving rebirth. Just as if a painter or an artist with paint or resin of turmeric, blue, or crimson were to create an image of a man or a woman on a well-polished board or a canvas. In just the same way, if there is lust, relishing, and craving for material food, consciousness becomes fixated there and grows. Where consciousness is fixated and growing, there is the reincarnation of mentality and physical form, the growth of conceptual activities, appearance and repeated existence in the future, birth, aging, and death in the future. That is sorrowful, depressing, and full of despair, I say. Samyutta Nikaya 12:64.
Insight 2.2, Impermanence of Feelings. The origin of feelings is said to be contact. Perhaps stimulus would be a better rendering of the Pali Bhasa. Contact is the normal condition for feeling independent origination, and is also the condition for perception and conceptual activities. Samyutta Nikaya 22.56 and 22.82, etc. Contact is said to be the coming together of three things: the internal sense organ, the eye, the external sense object, form, and the corresponding consciousness, visual consciousness. The following passage beautifully shows how deep insight into the dependence of feeling on contact is related to samadhi. The purified equanimity that the passage speaks of is, of course, the equanimity of the fourth jhana. When contemplation of the five material elements is completed, further monks, there remains only consciousness, purified and bright. And what does one cognize with that consciousness? One cognizes pleasure, pain, neither pleasure nor pain, dependent on a contact to be felt as pleasant, arises pleasant feeling. Feeling that pleasant feeling, one understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. One understands, due to the cessation of just that contact to be felt as pleasant, the corresponding pleasant feeling ceases and stills, and so on for painful and neutral feelings. Just as from the contact and friction of two sticks, heat is born, fire appears, and due to the separation and laying down of those same two sticks, that corresponding heat ceases and stills. And further, there remains only equanimity, purified and bright, soft, workable, and radiant. Suppose a skilled goldsmith or goldsmith's apprentice were to prepare a furnace and heat the crucible, take some gold in a pair of tongs, and place it in that crucible. Then from time to time he would blow air, from time to time he would sprinkle water, and from time to time he would watch over with equanimity. The gold would become refined, well refined, thoroughly refined, cleansed, rid of dross, soft, workable, and radiant, and could be used for whatever kind of adornment be desired, whether bracelets, earrings, necklaces, or golden garlands. So too there remains only equanimity, purified and bright, soft, workable, and radiant. He understands thus, if I were to apply this equanimity so pure and bright to the base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception, and develop my mind accordingly, this equanimity of mine, dependent on that, grasping that as its fuel, would endure for a long time. He understands thus, this is conditioned by conceptual activities. He does not form any volition or act of will for existence or non-existence. He does not grasp at anything in the world. Not grasping, he's not anxious. Not being anxious, he personally attains final nibbana. He understands birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what was to be done has been done, and there is no returning to this state of existence. If he feels a pleasant, painful, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands this is impermanent. That is not to be adhered to. That is not relished. He feels it as one detached. Feeling a feeling of the ending of the body, he understands, I am feeling a feeling of the ending of the body. Feeling a feeling of the ending of life, he understands, I am feeling a feeling of the ending of life. He understands, with the breakup of the body, at the end of life, all that is felt, not being relished, will become cool right here. Just as a lamp burning dependent on oil and wick, with the finishing of that oil and wick, without any other fuel, would be quenched with no fuel. Majjhima Nikaya 140:19-24. Insight 2.3, Impermanence of the Mind. In the discussion of the conditions for the four satipatthanas, the Buddha said that the condition for the mind is mentality and materiality, nama-rupa. Once more, this definition, while initially obscure, refers to a well-defined set of concepts used in dependent origination. There is a difference in that, in dependent origination, the term vijnana, consciousness, is used instead of citta, mind. Actually, here, as usual, the two words are synonyms. The difference is not in the meaning of the words, but in their connotations. Citta is frequently used in the context of practice, where it signifies the developed mind of samadhi, while vijnana is more typically used in an analytical, vipassana-style context. In other words, citta pertains to the fourth noble truth, while vijnana pertains to the first three. In Satipatthana, we have a context which, though although primarily used for teaching how to develop the citta as part of the fourth noble truth, is here being extended to cover the understanding of impermanence, and so it is treated in a way similar to vijnana. In the context of dependent origination, mentality is defined as feeling, perception, volition, contact, and attention. Physical form is the elements of earth, water, fire, and air, as well as derived physical form. Samyutta Nikaya 12.2. Together, these correspond with the first four of the five aggregates, physical form, feeling, perception, conceptual activities, which are called the stations for consciousness. Samyutta Nikaya 22.55, etc. Nama in the suttas excludes consciousness and so is not a blanket term for the four mental aggregates, although it is often used as such in later literature. In other words, these factors are the support based on which consciousness thrives. They support consciousness in a number of ways. Physical form directly supports consciousness in the external objects of the senses, as well as the subtle forms, images, etc., which, though appearing in mind consciousness, retain certain physical qualities, such as color and shape. In addition, physical form makes up the body, which provides the physical basis for the sense organs. The components of mentality can support consciousness directly as object, as, for example, when one is aware of a feeling or memory, or indirectly by performing essential cognitive functions. For example, feeling provides the affective tone that attracts or repels consciousness. Perception provides the framework for making sense of experience, and so on. At a basic level, these factors make sense consciousness work. On more complex levels, they weld the diverse elements of experience into the elaborate superstructure of language and concepts. This is why the Pali word we have translated as mentality is nama, literally name. All this is external or objective to consciousness, defining, determining, and delimiting subjective experience. The terminology of nama-rupa was adopted by the Buddha from the pre-Buddhist Upanishadic philosophy. In the Upanishads, nama-rupa refers to the limited and diverse names and shapes in the world, each of which has its own identity, like a river. But for the enlightened one, they flow and merge together into infinite consciousness, like the great ocean. In stating that consciousness was itself dependent on nama-rupa, the Buddha was turning this Upanishadic idea on its head. Consciousness is not an independent metaphysical absolute, but a part of everyday empirical reality, as fragile and dependent as anything else. Consciousness grows or decays together with nama-rupa at each stage in a person's life. If, Ananda, consciousness were not reincarnated in the mother's womb, would mentality and physical form take shape in the mother's womb? No, Bhante. If, Ananda, consciousness, having been reincarnated in the mother's womb, were to be miscarried, would mentality and physical form appear into this state of existence? No, Bhante. If, Ananda, the consciousness of a young boy or girl were to be cut off, would mentality and physical form attain to growth, increase, and maturity? No, Bhante. If, Ananda, consciousness were not fixated in mentality and physical form, would the production of birth, aging, death, and the origin of suffering in the future be found? No, Bhante. Digha Nikaya 15.21. It is simply the nature of the mind to pass away, but it is not content to leave no trace. Instead, the inner world of the mind becomes amplified through the forces of kamma into the worlds of rebirth, also called stations for consciousness. Digha Nikaya 15.33. This process depends on the idea of self, which is intimately linked with labels and language. We stick a label saying I, me, mine on the diverse items of baggage and experience, which one then feels obliged to claim and lug around. Moment to moment, year to year, life to life, the baggage changes, but the message on the labels stays the same. The construction of a self, which takes up so much of our mental energy, is a device to convince us that I will last forever, despite the fact that everything changes. Even death is not enough to let go. Thus, the fascination of the mind with its makings is the thread which weaves the fabric of time. Thus far, Ananda, could one be born, age, die, pass away, and be reborn. Thus far is the range of designation. Thus far is the range of language. Thus far is the range of concepts. Thus far is the domain of understanding. Thus far whirls the round for describing this state of existence, that is, mentality and physical form together with consciousness. Dīgha-Nikāya 15.22. The impermanence and mutual dependence of nama-rūpa and consciousness, then, is a very profound thing, perhaps the most profound of the Buddha's insights. It does not mean that one simply observes the rise and fall of the stuff of experience that appears in the present moment. It is about the untying of existence, the ending of time itself. Just as when ghee or oil is burnt, neither ashes nor soot are to be found, so too when Dhamma Malaputta rose into the air and, seated cross-legged in the sky, attained final nibbana after attaining to and withdrawing from the fire element, his body burnt up, and neither ashes nor soot were to be found. And the Blessed One, realizing the meaning of that, was then inspired to utter, "The body broke up, perception ceased, feelings all disappeared, conceptual activities were calmed, and consciousness came to an end." Udana 8.9. Insight 2.4, Impermanence of Dhammas. Once again, the saying that Dhammas are originated by attention might seem obscure, but a little inquiry shows the meaning clearly enough. Attention is the normal rendering of the Pali Manasikara. It refers to the act of turning the mind, for example, to a sense field or a topic of inquiry. In Buddhist psychology, it is closely associated with investigation into causality, so Manasikara is normally prefixed by Yoniso. The yoni is the womb, so yoniso manasikara is paying attention to the root or cause. The opposite, ayoniso manasikara, means paying attention away from the root. In other words, allowing the mind to drift from what is essential, to wander off the topic and be confused about what is happening. In saying that Dhammas are originated by attention, the Buddha is pointing out in particular the relation between the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors. These two sets of dhammas are frequently set against one another. The meditator is said to give rise to the hindrances by paying attention away from the root, while the enlightenment factors are developed by paying attention to the root. This is pointing to the conditioned nature of these mental qualities. Good and bad qualities do not just happen, they have a cause. By understanding that cause and using the mind in the right way, bad qualities can be undone and good qualities increased. My comparative study of this part of the Satipatthana Sutta has convinced me that this is what is meant by saying that Dhammas are originated by attention, a conclusion supported by the traditional commentary on this phrase. Nevertheless, as it stands today, the text has a broader application since paying attention to the root is fundamental to the investigation of the other categories included in the contemplation of Dhammas, such as the five aggregates, the six senses, and especially the four noble truths. Due to not paying attention to the dhammas unfit for attention, and paying attention to dhammas fit for attention, unarisen poisons do not arise, and arisen poisons are abandoned. He pays attention to the root. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. Paying attention in this way, three fetters are abandoned in him: identity view, doubt, and misapprehension of virtue and vows. Majjhima Nikaya 2:10-11. By bringing in the investigation into causality so explicitly here,
the Buddha is emphasizing the strong role that wisdom plays in the final of the four Satipatthanas. Note, attention is prominently featured in the context of Dipijan origination, for example, Digha Nikaya 14.2.18. Incidentally, in the phrase appearing below at Digha Nikaya 14.2.21, the Vipassana path to enlightenment, the word Vipassana was inserted into the PTS Pali from the commentary despite lacking any manuscript support. But this inquiry is not divorced from the tranquility that has been so characteristic of the Buddha's whole approach to meditation. On the contrary, it is understanding how cause and effect works in the very process of meditation itself, as is shown in the teaching on the nine dhammas that are very helpful. What nine dhammas are very helpful? The nine dhammas rooted in paying attention to the root. In one paying attention to the root, gladness is born. In one who is glad, rapture is born. In one with rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One with tranquil body feels bliss. One who is blissful, the mind enters samadhi. With mind and samadhi, one knows and sees in accordance with reality. Knowing and seeing in accordance with reality, one is repulsed. Being repulsed, lust fades away. Due to fading away, one is released. These are the nine dhammas that are very helpful. Digha Nikaya 34.2.2. This passage suggests the meaning of paying attention to the root, a systematic, thoroughgoing inquiry, not distracted by superficial issues, which focuses awareness precisely where it counts, staying at that point until it opens up to wisdom, and the mind moves not onwards, but inwards, not from one leaf to another, but from a leaf to a branch to the trunk, and all the way down to the roots. Insight 3. Knowledge. The third aspect of insight development involves the establishing of mindfulness only for a measure of knowledge and mindfulness. The kinds of knowledge that can be developed are not described further. The interpretation of the Vipassana schools would bring in the so-called insight knowledges here, but this list dates from many centuries after the Buddha and cannot have been meant here. Luckily, there is a sutta where Venerable Anuruddha details the kinds of knowledge obtainable by Satipatthana. Many of these are normally associated with samadhi practice, especially the various kinds of psychic knowledge. But in the suttas, they belong firmly in the wisdom category. As with all deep wisdom, the suttas state that these knowledges are for one with samadhi, not for one without samadhi. Anguttara Nikaya 6.64. It is from the development and making much of these four establishings of mindfulness that I have attained such great direct knowledge. I directly know 1,000 worlds. I recollect 1,000 aeons. I wield the various kinds of psychic powers. I have the purified divine ear which surpasses the human. I understand the minds of other beings. I understand in accordance with reality the possible as possible and the impossible as impossible. I understand in accordance with reality the fruits of undertaking actions past, future, and present, the goals of all paths of practice, the many and various elements, the various dispositions of beings, the spiritual faculties of other beings, the defilement, cleansing, and emergence of jhanas, liberations, samadhi, and attainments. I recollect various past lives. I understand with the divine eye how beings pass on according to their actions. I enter and abide, due to the evaporation of the poisons, in the poison-free release of heart, released by understanding, having witnessed it here and now with my own direct knowledge. Samyutta Nikaya 52.6, 11-24. Insight 4. Independence. The insight section of the Satipatthana Sutta concludes with the following statement: one abides independent, not grasping at anything in the world. Majjhima Nikaya 10.5 and Digha Nikaya 22.2. For advanced practitioners, this is taught as the comprehensive detachment from any aspect of existence, such as Majjhima Nikaya 143. But another aspect of independence is particularly relevant to stream entry. The four Satipatthanas are taught and described by me
for the abandoning and surmounting of these dependencies on views connected with former times and dependencies on views connected with times to come. Digha Nikaya 29:40. This passage makes a direct link between the practice of Satipatthana and the overcoming of views. The views connected with the past concern the idea of a self as providing a link between this life and previous lives, which views of the future concern future lives. In other words, if we think of our self as an identical, unchanging essence, then in understanding the past, we will naturally postulate that this very same self existed in past lives and will exist in future lives. Thinking in this way will obscure the true nature of conditions, the fact that even here and now, we are constantly changing and altering with conditions. So how much more so in the past and the future? The reality is that all experience in the past or future is based on the same conditional principles that may be observed here in the present. Hence, an understanding of past and future lives comes not from a metaphysical theory of a self, but from observing the changing nature of consciousness according to dependent origination. All these contemplatives and Brahmins who hold settled views about the past and the future and assert on 62 grounds various conceptual theorems referring to the past and the future experience these feelings only by repeated contacts through the six bases of contact. Due to feeling as condition, there arises in them craving. Due to craving as condition, there is grasping. Due to grasping as condition, there is ongoing existence. Due to existence as condition, there is birth. Due to birth as condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, bodily pain, mental despair, and suffering come to be. When a monk understands in accordance with reality the origin, ending, gratification, danger, and escape regarding the sense bases of contact, then he understands what lies beyond all of these views. Digha Nikaya 1:144. In this passage, views are traced to an innocuous origin in the very process of sense perception. Contact is where the inner and outer meet, the interface of the self and the world. That moment is not a neutral record of data, as for example, a camera. All we see, hear, and sense is interpreted, classified, sorted out by the mind, and crucially, we either like or dislike or are neutral. This sets up the dynamic of the mind that moves, pulled this way and that by sense experience. Our cravings and desire grow, and we form various theories of identification, such as by saying, "This is mine, this is not mine." Through this process, our attachment to rebirth propels us on to life after life. Views of self in the past and future are classified by Buddhism as annihilationism and eternalism. Each of these classes of views encompasses many variations, but the most familiar form of annihilationism is the belief that this physical realm is all that there is, and after death there is no other life. Eternalism typically postulates an everlasting soul that survives death and lives forever in a blissful or painful state. According to the Buddha, these are extreme views, neither of which does justice to the complexity and nuance of reality as we experience it. Never in our life do we actually experience a moment of consciousness that actually ends, with nothing coming after. Since this is simply not part of our experience, how can we insist that this is what happens after death? Similarly, never do we experience a state of permanence or eternity, nor can we even imagine what such a state might be. Both of these views fail the simple test of Buddhist empiricism. Can they be reasonably inferred from actual experience? Life involves both change and continuity, both unity and diversity. Buddhist philosophy accepts both of these aspects and insists that they cannot be taken as absolutes. This twofold philosophical approach calls for a twofold meditative response, samatha and vipassana. Samatha is a joyous plunge into oneness, the inner waters of the mind. When we experience the ending of the five external senses, we can no longer believe that only externals are real,
and will turn away from annihilationism. Vipassana discloses the radical discontinuity of consciousness, dispelling the belief in an eternal soul. Since it is only suffering that ceases, the gradual stilling of activities is experienced as exquisite bliss by the meditator. One can at last be truly independent, as one experiences for oneself the fading away of suffering. Faith in this process of peace enables the meditator to loosen, then untie the shackles binding the mind to the world, free of the fear that there could be any kind of existing self to be destroyed. This is the right view of the stream enterer. Activities are impermanent, their natures to rise and fall. Having arisen, they cease. Their stilling is bliss. Digha Nikaya 16, 6-10. Conclusion, Satipatthana and Insight. Contemplation of rise and fall refers not to an objective, pseudo-scientific scrutiny of phenomena out there, independent of the observer, but to seeing the way the mind entangles itself in the world, altering what is known by the very act of knowing. This implies that it is the understanding of the mind itself, the faculty of knowing, which is the crucial element in the delicate process of disentanglement. Mind consciousness is the resort of the five senses, the functional center coordinating experience, and the subjective sense of individual identity linking life to life. While samadhi plays an important role in all aspects of insight, its home base is the contemplation of mind. So, samadhi is the straight road from virtue to wisdom, focusing attention right at the heart of the matter and providing a perspective for the other aspects of insight. The bases of psychic power. These are enthusiasm, energy, mind, and inquiry. Dependent on enthusiasm, energy, mind, and inquiry, one gains samadhi. One gains one-pointedness of mind. When endowed with active striving, this is the base of psychic power consisting of enthusiasm, energy, mind, and inquiry. Samyutta Nikaya 51.13 condensed. Thus, these are various mental qualities which predominate in gaining samadhi. Enthusiasm is a wholesome mode of desire, not the worldly desire to be or have, but especially in the context of samadhi, the desire to know. Both enthusiasm and energy are compassed within the path factor of right effort in its role as requisite of samadhi. Inquiry is wisdom in its mode of investigation into the reasons for progress or decline in meditation. Mind here denotes samadhi itself. The word mind, citta, is a common synonym for samadhi. It is not defined further here, but as it is a basis for psychic power, there is no doubt as to the meaning. That a monk without refined, peaceful, tranquil, and unified samadhi would wield the various kinds of psychic power or witness the evaporations of the poisons, that is not possible. Anguttara Nikaya 6.70. An interesting analysis details the manner of developing all four of these factors. Here, monks, a monk develops the basis of psychic power consisting of samadhi due to enthusiasm, energy, mind, and inquiry, and active striving, thinking, thus my enthusiasm will be neither too slack nor too tense, and it will neither constricted within, due to sloth and torpor, nor distracted externally due to the sense pleasures. He abides perceiving before and after, as before, so after, so before, as below, so above, so below. As by day, so by night, as by night, so by day. Thus, with open heart and unenveloped, he develops a mind imbued with luminosity. Samyutta Nikaya 51.20. As below, so above is explained in the sutta with reference to the meditation on the parts of the body, upwards from the soles of the feet, and downward from the tips of the hairs. As before, so after, probably refers to evenness in attending to the meditation subject throughout the session. The phrase well apprehended, well attended, well borne in mind, well penetrated with understanding is used here just as with the basis for reviewing,
implying that reviewing and inquiring into causes is a key to developing this evenness. This inquiry will investigate the causal relationships between the basis of psychic power themselves, in line with similar relationships described elsewhere. Enthusiasm is the wish, the motivation to do the work of purifying the mind. Effort is the actual exertion of energy to do the work. The purified mind is the result of that work, and the clarity of the purified mind, the causes and conditions for that purity, can be discerned through inquiry. These qualities work together like an electric light. Enthusiasm is like the voltage in the circuits. Energy is like the current of electricity which flows when the switch is turned on. The mind is like the globe lighting up. And when the room is lit, it's easy to see what is there. Spiritual faculties and powers. The spiritual faculties and powers are simply different aspects of the same set of principles. Samyutta Nikaya 48:43, which are faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and understanding. Here is one description of how they work together. Bhante, a noble disciple who is absolutely dedicated to the Tathagata with full confidence, would not doubt or be uncertain about the Tathagata or the Tathagata's dispensation. It is to be expected, Bhante, of a noble disciple that he will abide with energy aroused for the abandoning of unbeneficial qualities and the undertaking of beneficial qualities, that he will be strong, firm in exertion, not shirking from his responsibilities regarding beneficial qualities. His energy is his spiritual faculty of energy. It is to be expected, Bhante, of a faithful noble disciple whose energy is aroused that he will be mindful, endowed with supreme mindfulness and mastery over the senses, able to remember and recall what was said and done long ago. His mindfulness is his spiritual faculty of mindfulness. It is to be expected, Bhante, of a faithful noble disciple whose energy is aroused and whose mindfulness is established that, having made relinquishment the support, he will gain samadhi. He will gain one-pointedness of mind. His samadhi is his spiritual faculty of samadhi. It is to be expected, Bhante, of a faithful noble disciple whose energy is aroused, whose mindfulness is established, and whose mind is concentrated in samadhi, that he will understand. Inconceivable is samsara's beginning. For beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, a starting point of roaming on and faring on is not found. But the remainderless fading away and cessation of that dark mass of ignorance, that state is peaceful, that state is sublime, that is the samatha of all activities, the relinquishment of all belongings, the evaporation of craving, fading away, cessation, nibbana. His understanding is his spiritual faculty of understanding. The faithful noble disciple, having thus repeatedly practiced striving, remembering, samadhi, and understanding, has full confidence thus. These principles, which I have previously only heard about, I now abide having personally contacted, and see having penetrated with understanding. These principles are conveniently elaborated in groups of four, bringing them in line with the corresponding path factors. Faith should be seen in the four factors of stream entry: faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and perfect virtue. Energy in the four right efforts, mindfulness in the four satipatthanas, samadhi in the four jhanas, and understanding in the four noble truths. Samyutta Nikaya 48:8. However, understanding is most commonly defined as the noble and penetrative understanding of arising and ending which leads to the complete evaporation of suffering. Samyutta Nikaya 48:9. The phrase, having made relinquishment the support, one gains samadhi, is unique to the spiritual faculties. The precise meaning may be read a number of ways, which I discuss further below. However we read this, it should not be seen as an alternative to jhana, since the phrase itself is sometimes followed by the full jhana formula, Samyutta Nikaya 48:10. The spiritual powers are defined similarly, the sole difference being the absence of the phrase, having made relinquishment the support, Anguttara Nikaya 7:4, 5:14, and 5:15. Since the spiritual faculties and powers are identical, that phrase cannot add anything crucial to the definition or justify extending the scope of the spiritual faculty of samadhi beyond the four jhanas. Each of the spiritual faculties and powers are further described as being developed together with each of the four jhanas. Anguttara Nikaya 1:20. When practicing in this way, even for the duration of a finger snap, does the teacher's bidding, responds to instruction, and does not waste the nation's alms food. Strikingly, the texts set the spiritual faculties apart from the other sets comprised within the Wings to Awakening by treating them under all four of the Noble Truths, not just the fourth. Samyutta Nikaya 48:2-7. This treatment foreshadows the terminological development already nascent in the suttas of faculty as a general phenomenological classification parallel to the aggregates, sense bases, and elements. Normally, of course, all these groups are considered to fall under the topic of the path as the fourth noble truth. By treating the spiritual faculties under all four noble truths, the suttas invite us to contemplate that the path, too, is conditioned, impermanent, and still subject to suffering. This is the task of the spiritual faculty of understanding itself, defined precisely as understanding rise and fall. So to possess the faculties, one must understand the faculties. The faculties should be seen as arising dependent on each other, and this interdependence shows how the mind works, not just in the context of the spiritual faculties, but in everything. The one who perfects this understanding in accordance with reality is the stream enterer. For example, Samyutta Nikaya 48:2. Hence, although as mental qualities they are to be developed by the ordinary person, only with the entrance to the noble path do they gain control, becoming the predominating dispositions in their own field, thus meriting the title spiritual faculties. Majjhima Nikaya 26:21. Although the term spiritual faculties may be used in a more general sense, this is not identified with the group of five. Not only does the presence or absence of the spiritual faculties serve to distinguish between the ordinary person and the noble ones, the relative strength of the faculties is a key criterion for classifying the noble ones in terms of spiritual potential, level of attainment, and mode of practice. To return to the obscure phrase, having made relinquishment the support, we should consider this in light of such passages as the following, which describe how the noble ones meditate. In this passage, taints of the mind does not refer, as elsewhere, to the five hindrances, but to the manifestations of greed, anger, and delusion abandoned by the stages of the noble path. When he has given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished the taints of the mind, in part, he thinks, I am endowed with confirmed confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. He gains inspiration in the meaning, inspiration in the Dhamma, gladness connected with the Dhamma. In one who is glad, rapture is born. In one whose mind is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. One with tranquil body feels bliss. The mind of one who is blissful enters samadhi. Majjhima Nikaya 7:8. This passage describes how someone who has already reached at least stream entry finds joy in this fact. This joy and lightness of heart at having overcome some of the deepest afflictions of the mind itself becomes the foundation for gaining samadhi. Confirmed confidence is the clarity from having undergone the experience of forever relinquishing defilements, thereby walking in the Buddha's footsteps, seeing the Dhamma, and becoming one of the noble Sangha. Here, the spiritual faculty of faith is predominant in the meditation subject of recollecting the triple gem. Energy is implied in the undertaking of meditation, while mindfulness is the act of recollecting. Samadhi here is obviously noble right samadhi, equivalent to the spiritual faculty of samadhi. The word for relinquishment, patanissaga, is slightly different from that in the spiritual faculty of samadhi, vossaga, but the meaning is surely the same. If we are on the right track, then it would seem that the reason why the unique phrase, having made relinquishment the support, appears before the jhana formula in the definition of the spiritual faculty of samadhi, is linked to the fact that only the noble ones actually possess the spiritual faculties in the true sense. Only they have their course of meditation smoothed by the root-level eradication of defilements. supported by the relinquishment of defilements, it is much easier for them to gain samadhi. In the above sutta, the monk next develops the divine abidings, and then the sutta shows how the highest wisdom is attained. He understands thus, there is this, there is the inferior, there is the superior, and beyond there is an escape from the whole field of perception. As so often in the suttas, this laconic phrase appears almost willfully obscure, but the phrase field of perception invites comparison with such passages as the Puttapada Sutta, which then offers a key to the interpretation. Digha Nikaya 9.10, quoted below. See too Itivaga 72 and 73. This would then refer to the divine abidings, the inferior to the sensual realm, the superior to the formless liberations, while the escape is Nibbana. So the spiritual faculties, relying on the partial relinquishment of defilements by the trainees, mature into total relinquishment of defilements by the Arahant. The enlightenment factors. They lead to enlightenment, therefore they are called enlightenment factors. Samyutta Nikaya 46.5. See also the Itivaga 72 and 73. The seven enlightenment factors are mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, energy, rapture, tranquility, samadhi, and equanimity. Generally, they may be regarded as a presentation of the meditative aspect of the path, complementary to the bases for psychic power and the spiritual faculties. The very first sutta of the collection on the enlightenment factors, however, emphasizes the indispensability of virtuous ethical conduct as their foundation. Samyutta Nikaya 46.1. Mindfulness and investigation of dhammas include both the recollection and investigation of teachings, as well as the discriminative contemplation of presently arisen phenomena. Energy and tranquility include both physical and mental aspects. Rapture and samadhi occur either with initial and sustained application of mind in the first jhana, or without in the higher jhanas. Equanimity is the crowning quality of samatha, reaching perfection in the fourth jhana and the fourth divine abiding. A whole series of texts deals with the opposition between the enlightenment factors and the five hindrances. This is presented both as a general appraisal of the two sets as leading to or obstructing enlightenment, and as a specific analysis, especially in terms of the distinctive nutriment for each factor. The gradual assimilation of the nutriments through repeated attention nurtures the growth of either good or bad qualities. Sometimes a specific enlightenment factor opposes a specific hindrance. The nutriment for investigation of dhammas, discriminating between good and bad, starves the hindrance of doubt. The nutriment of energy, the elements of arousal, of exertion, of persistence, starve the hindrance of sloth and torpor. Tranquility opposes restlessness and remorse. Samadhi is nurtured by those things that are the basis of samatha, the basis of not many pointedness. Samyutta Nikaya 46.51. Each of the enlightenment factors may be developed in conjunction with various meditation subjects, a skeleton, a decaying corpse, the divine abidings, mindfulness of breathing, and the perceptions of ugliness, death, the repulsiveness of food, boredom with the whole world, impermanence, suffering not self, abandonment, fading away, and cessation. Developed in this way, these meditations are of great fruit and benefit, lead to arahantship or non-returning, to great good, security from bondage, a sense of urgency, and a comfortable abiding. Samyutta Nikaya 46.57. One passage describes how the enlightenment factors arise through recollecting the Dhamma of the Noble Ones. Here, spiritual rapture seems to encompass rapture arisen prior to jhana, but only, of course, as a prelude to jhana, not as a replacement for it. On one occasion, when a monk abiding withdrawn remembers and thinks over that Dhamma, the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is aroused, developed, and fulfilled. Abiding thus mindfully, he investigates, explores, and inquires into that Dhamma with understanding. His energy is roused up and persistent. Spiritual rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body and the mind become tranquil. In one whose body is tranquil, there is bliss.
The mind of one whose body is tranquil and who is blissful enters samadhi. One watches closely with equanimity the mind thus concentrated in samadhi. Thus, all the factors of enlightenment are roused, developed, and fulfilled. Samyutta Nikaya 46.3. Samatha and vipassana are intimately interlaced through all these teachings. It's noteworthy, though, that most of these factors pertain to samatha, while only investigation of dhammas pertains specifically to vipassana, and even this is chiefly treated in its mode of supporting samadhi. Indeed, these seven dhammas sometimes simply substitute for samadhi in the grouping virtue, dhamma, and understanding. Note, this grouping occurs several times in the suttas, usually glossed by the commentary as dhammas pertaining to samadhi, but as far as I know, only explained in the suttas as in Itivagga 397 as the seven dhammas that are wings to enlightenment, which is often translated as the seven sets of dhammas that are wings to enlightenment. Now, it is well known that the 37 are not called wings to enlightenment in the suttas. The term is used of the spiritual faculties, however, as there are many descriptive terms common to both the spiritual faculties and the enlightenment factors, I feel it would be easier for an epithet to transfer from one set to another than from one set to the whole group of sets. Moreover, dhamma is more idiomatically used of the members of the set rather than of the set as a whole. The emphasis throughout it is simply on the development of the mind. Many terms used with these principles, seclusion, fading away, cessation, relinquishment, abandoning, ending, stilling, and others, are also used of the four jhanas, vipassana, and even nibbana itself, underlining the essential kinship of these facets of the path and the goal. The Wings to Enlightenment, a Conclusion. Examining these 37 wings to enlightenment, consistent patterns emerge. The sequences start with the more basic qualities, faith, or enthusiasm, or energy. The placing of investigation of dhammas near the start of the enlightenment factors is reminiscent of the placing of right view at the start of the Eightfold Path. With energy and mindfulness in operation, the mind develops the joy which leads to samadhi, ripening in liberation. Fundamental principles of the nature of the mind are embodied in these formulations. At each stage, the emotional and intellectual qualities are balanced and support each other, while the variations warn against taking an overly rigid approach to development. In the next chapter, we will examine in more detail the relationships between these qualities. Thus, Ananda, beneficial virtues gradually proceed to the peak. Anguttara Nikaya 10.1.